You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 4th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
She's still dead.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
I'm still celebrating.
I can tell.
Sylvia's passing?
Yes, I am. Proudly.
But we're not supposed to be celebrating today. It's sad.
No,
sad
no.
From beginning to end.
Well, speaking of people's passing, today's December 7th. On December 7th, 1970, the world lost Rube Goldberg, who died at the age of 87.
Rube who Goldberg. Died at the hands of a very complicated machine.
Easy joke there.
I know. Someone had to say it.
We're just trying to warm up here.
Beat me to it.
Yes. Rube Goldberg was best known as the cartoonist who would satirize an increasingly technological world using cartoons with people using very complex machines in order to solve otherwise simple tasks. And you see influences, the people he influenced everywhere. There's a popular video by OK Go within the last couple of years.
Oh, there's that's an awesome video.
The new commercial for Goldie Blocks that was just traveling around the inner parts.
Wallace of Wallace and Gromit?
Did he do Rube Goldberg? It's been
the nerdy scientist who came up with these elaborate Rube Goldberg inventions in order to accomplish something very simple, like eating breakfast or getting dressed.
Yeah. All I remembered is that he liked cheese.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if Rube Goldberg did. There was the beginning of Back to the Future.
Yeah.
In Doc's lab.
Sure.
And the popular game when I was a kid, Mousetrap.
Mousetrap.
Oh, yeah.
I have no idea how that game was actually played. All we ever did was just set up.
Build it.
Me too.
The trap.
And you do it like a few times and then that was it. You're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we were done with it.
Did you guys know that Rube, he won the Pulitzer Prize for political cartooning in 48?
Wow.
Pulitzer.
Pretty impressive.
I spent a Saturday, about a year ago, just looking at a couple of videos on YouTube. People in their own Rube Goldberg machines that they've come up with. I think I spent about 4 hours before I looked at the clock and realized, oh my gosh, I've been watching these forever. They are mesmerizing.
Did you ever play The Incredible Machine? It was a computer game back in, I guess, in the 80s or the 90s, and it was addictive. It was building Rube Goldberg machines in order to solve problems, but it was very open. I guess it was in the 90s. It was a lot of fun.
Sounds like fun.
The other notable thing for today was I didn't want to just do a death day. So happy birthday to psychologist Eleanor Gibson, who was born December 7th, 1910. Gibson is best known as being the person who came up with the study. She studied primarily perception in infants. That's what she was most famous for. And she's the one who came up with that study where she took a piece of glass and hung it over a table ledge, basically, and put babies on top of it and had them crawl across the ledge, coaxed by their parents. And many of the babies refused to do it. And that study helped show that infants have depth perception that informs their ability to stay out of danger. Also, fun baby test to do. Make your baby think you're trying to coax him over a dangerous ledge.
Yeah, it's a trust thing. You know, it's like Abraham killing his son.
Is that what it was?
Wow. I didn't know
just
we'd
like
go,
that.
Go all Bible.
You know, I remember when God said, yeah, slice open your son's throat, you know. And Abraham's like, really? Like,
just as Abraham was about to do it, God's like, I guess babies don't have death perception.
Psych.
What a bunch of morons. Here's a goat.
Well, let's get right into a nice controversial topic this week, shall we? This study's been making the rounds, and we got a lot of emails on this. New study looking at the brains of men and women, showing that men and women's brains are wired differently. Most news reports just report that straight up, you know, probably right from a press release. But this is actually a very complicated, nuanced, and interesting topic. I do have a little bit of an interest in the brain. Now, I do have to preface this entire discussion because we have talked in the past on the show about the fact that, you know, male-female is not a simple dichotomy. There are plenty of variations along the spectrum. But this entire research looking at, you know, male-female sex differences does treat it that way. So essentially they're just looking at people who are unambiguously male, unambiguously female, and treating it as, you know, as two distinct groups. For the sake of efficiency in the discussion and the rest of our discussion on this topic, we're going to just talk about men and women. So what they looked at was they did an interesting type of MRI scan using diffusion tensor imaging, which essentially models where water is moving in the brain. You could think of it that way. So essentially, it's a way of looking at the connectome, how neurons are connected to each other. It was a fairly robust study. They looked at 949 individuals of different ages, 428 males, 521 females, and just looked at the overall pattern of connections in the male and female brains. And what they found was that on average, the male brains tended to be more connected on the same hemisphere than female brains, while female brains tended to be more connected between the two hemispheres. So there were these different overall pattern of connections, which is interesting. It does support a lot of other research, which shows that women generally have more interconnectedness between their two hemispheres. Like, for example, studies looking at language shows that women tend to activate their two hemispheres much more when doing a language task than males, who tend to only activate their dominant hemisphere for language. So this is not surprising in that it's in line with prior research. So that's the, I think, the uncontroversial part of this study. Although, you know, you always have to consider, is the phenomenon real, right? Before you then go into what does the phenomenon mean? What does it tell us? You do have to ask, okay, well, how reliable are these results? Again, because it's in line with prior research, I think it's probably pretty reliable. The couple of things you always have to worry about when you're looking at male-female differences, men tend to be bigger than women, and male brains tend to be bigger than female brains because just in proportion to body size. Sometimes studies will show, oh, look, this is bigger in men than women. But it's, unless you're adjusting for the fact that men on average are bigger than women, then that the result could be spurious. So some people have raised the question, okay, would that in any way bias the results of this kind of analysis? And I don't know what the answer to that question is. I don't think there's any obvious way that it would, but there's always, you know, in the post-publication review of the community, it's got to be picked apart on these technical grounds. You know, is there any way that this data could be misleading, or it could be artifactual, or it could be something else other than actual differences in the way brains are hardwired that they're seeing here? But I didn't come across any major criticisms that seriously call into question the results. You know, it still needs to be properly vetted, but let's assume that the results themselves are reliable. So then the question is, of course, what does all this mean? And that's where no one really knows the answer to that question. The one thing I find interesting in discussions of this, and this is pretty much every news article about this, refer to this as hardwiring. And I know I use that term a lot, but actually, and I've written about this before, when pressed, I think that the software-hardware analogy doesn't really match the brain. The reason is that the brain is, there's no clean division between hardware and software. The hardware is the software. I think it's probably better just to call it wetware because it's different.
So, Steve, are you saying that our programming is cooked into the structure of our brain?
Well, okay, so the programming is the connections. It is the structure. It's not like you have hardware, then you have software written to the hardware. The hardware is the software. And you add to that the fact of plasticity, that hardware, you know, the connections change with use. That's what learning and memory is. That's what training is. Just experience. You know, and everything your brain experiences changes the connections, which is not analogous to a computer. You're not, you know, actually changing your processor when you store information on your computer. So, you know, I just think that that analogy breaks down, and I think it does, the poor analogy does affect the way people think about studies like this, and makes them inter- interpret it too simply, or even just keep them from being able to discuss it in a meaningful way. Because then you get down to this false dichotomy of, okay, so are these differences that we're seeing between male and female brains, assuming it's real, is this something that is determined by genetics and development, or is this something that's determined by environment and experience? Because people are thinking hardware, software. It's like, well, but the brain is wetware. It's got to be both because, to some degree. And the real question always is not whether it's A or B, nature, nurture, whatever. It's what's the proportion? What's the effect between the two? Because it's always going to be a combination. I mean, the brain developed, evolved to interact with the environment and to change. It's meant to be a plastic changing organ. That's the whole point. That's kind of the purpose of the brain. So there isn't this clean divide. The way I think, I've come to understand it or think about it and trying to make sense of all of this kind of research is that we are born with and develop tendencies. What psychologists might call the default mode of operation, but like a neuroscientist would call just a predisposition or the sort of default wiring of the brain. But plasticity allows us to change it. So there's going to be statistical differences when you look at groups, large numbers of groups of people, you're going to find statistical differences based upon whatever hormonal effects there are. We know that hormones affect brain development and affect brain function. There's going to be differences based upon genetics. But what's the magnitude of those group-based statistical differences versus the magnitude of the differences within groups? I reviewed the literature on sex differences in terms of like how early can we detect sex differences and what are those studies showing? So like I know we've talked briefly on the show before about toy preference in infants. And that whole area of research is actually really fascinating. This is what I found. It's uncontroversial that there are male-female differences in toy preferences. And this goes down to before 6 months old, that boys and girls will look longer at, girls will look longer at dolls, boys will look longer at trucks, and then that they actually have a preference for playing with those toys when they get old enough to actually interact with them, to actually play with them. There's no consensus. I really couldn't find anything that I would call a consensus on whether or not those differences are socially constructed or whether they're genetically hormonally determined. And there's reasons to think both. So in terms of environmental influence, there are certain things where there's actually no difference in color preference between boys and girls. Did you guys know that? As infants? Yeah, boys and girls equally, they all prefer blue over other colors, regardless of sex or gender. And then as boys get older, they lose their preference for things like pink. They actually then like almost develop an aversion to that. That's almost definitely socially constructed.
Seriously, like I actually don't really like the color pink, and yeah. that was somehow taught to me by my environment.
Well, it's hard to make an individual statement based upon group data, right? Who knows what your individual history was or preferences were or whatever. But if you look at there's no statistical difference if you look at 6 to 12 month olds, but then by 18 months, boys start preferring blue to pink. If you look at toy preference, actually, yet less than 12 months old, boys and girls prefer dolls to trucks. But boys have more of a preference for trucks than girls do. And then after 12 months old, between like 18 months old, boys start losing their preference for dolls and they prefer trucks more. And it's also true that boys become more narrow in their toy choice, while girls remain more diverse. They'll play with anything. So it's interesting. There does seem to be a cultural influence there because of the way it phases in as they age.
But I just want to mention really quickly before you move on that there's toy preference studies. Some of them are quite controversial, particularly I know they attempted to solve the is it culture problem. Some researchers studied toy preference in chimps, I believe it was, and found that male chimps preferred trucks and female chimps preferred dolls. And it was frankly ridiculous because the chimp has no idea what a truck is. And so there was a lot of extrapolating, like,
Yeah.
You know, well, MailChimp's like manly things, like trucks, you know, when the chimp has no idea of what a manly thing is and no idea what that toy truck represents, you know, so there's a lot of controversy surrounding the interpretation of a lot of those results.
Couldn't it be argued also that a child under 12 months is in the same position? They don't know what a truck is.
Yeah,
I would think that there might be a disposition, though, more towards dolls because of the facial features and how children, you know, from a very, very young age are, you know, recognizing the facial features of their parents and the other people in their family.
Right. So that's true. So you could look at this a couple of ways. There are studies, and I saw one with rhesus monkeys, but it's been repeated in several species of non-human primates where the same type of toy truck preference seems to come out. And the researchers interpret that as, well, yeah, they don't understand what a truck is, but, you know, that the female rhesus monkeys prefer soft, plushy things and the males prefer moving, hard, mechanical things, even though they don't understand what a truck is. There's just still something very fundamental or basic about it that just is more attractive to them. So I don't think that completely dismisses that line of evidence. The other line of evidence that's very interesting, again, not to the point where it takes it out of the realm of being controversial, but if you look at girls who have adrenal hyperplasia, so they are XX females. They are completely females, but they have a problem that has nothing to do with their sex chromosomes or anything else. But that's just, it's an adrenal gland problem where they produce more androgens than a female otherwise would. And it's a range. You know, they could produce a little bit more or a lot more androgen. And studies have found that females raised and socialized as girls that have more androgen because of adrenal hyperplasia tend to have more of a male pattern of toy preference and play preference. You know, more rough and tumble, less touchy-feely. So it's all very complicated to do research into this kind of thing, but that's what the research that exists so far is showing. So it does suggest that maybe, and again, I don't think it's surprising, to be honest with you, that a hormone like androgen would affect the functioning of the brain. We know that oxytocin could make you feel feelings of love. You know, there was a recent study where they gave oxytocin to children with autism and it helped them bond more. I mean, you know, it's a bonding hormone. It affects your brain function. So it's not surprising that men and women who have different proportions of hormones that is affecting their brain function. So, but it's also, the research also shows that the differences within the groups though is greater than the difference between the groups. So, variation within girls and within boys is actually greater than the statistical difference that you're looking at between boys and girls. So
does that have to do with the plasticity you mentioned before, Steve?
I think it's a separate issue. So, I mean, I think that it could be relate to that to some degree, but I think even despite plasticity, it's just that it's like race, right? You're looking at racial differences. You find more differences within an alleged racial group than there is between racial groups. It's the same kind of thing. So it just means that these categories, in terms of brain function anyway, are very fuzzy, and there aren't these rigid, strict, like, this is a female brain, this is a male brain.
That, to me, though, is the biggest issue with this study, or one of the biggest issues with this study, is that it's being reported as these drastic differences between the brains of men and women. But the study is actually, the participants of the study were a subset of a large study that pretty conclusively showed that the sex differences within the study were insignificant. They were very difficult to tell who was a man, who was a woman, based upon what were supposed to be drastic sex differences.
Yep, not to say statistically insignificant.
No.
It just means small in magnitude in terms of their implication. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. I agree. I think this is an area where we find statistical differences, especially when you look at like 1,000 people, and you look at large numbers of people, of subjects, and we talked about this before, you know, how could you have something that's statistically significant that's not clinically significant, or a quote-unquote overpowered study? I don't know if this study would qualify as being overpowered, but certainly it's powered to show very slight differences to statistical significance. And then, but then, you know, the question is, well, yeah, but as you say, if you can't look at an individual and say, based upon this pattern, I have a high predictive value that you are, you know, sort them into one of the two groups, male or female, then that tells you that the within group differences are greater than the between group differences. And then you add to that plasticity, you know, maybe we're talking about the, you know, an influence or a starting position, but plasticity, I think, is also greater than what these differences that we're looking at. So, and by plasticity, of course, that means the environment. So, for example, it may be that there's a slight, you know, increased inclination towards one way or the other, male or female, and you'll be able to tease that out of large data sets. But for an individual, what matters is your life experience, your environment, what you're encouraged to do, your training, whatever. Let me make another analogy and take it out of the sex difference area. Because we talked before about research looking at chess masters. What the research showed is that anybody can get to the level of being a chess master. The real difference between different people, among different people, is how long it takes you to get there. Right. Some people might get there with 4,000 hours of playing chess, whereas other people might need 20,000 hours of playing chess. So that's the difference between nature and nurture right there. People may be born with different proclivities or talents or tendencies, but with enough environmental influence, training or practice in this case, you know, plasticity can overwhelm that. So whereas, you know, boys and girls may be starting in slightly different places, that actually, because, you know, I think while the research is showing, yeah, they probably are starting in different places, but it's also showing that those differences are pretty small compared to the plasticity, the power of plasticity to boys and girls to end up wherever they want. All right. Well, we're going to move on. Bob, you're going to tell us this item almost seems like it was made up to be like just a Bob item. Wormhole entangled quantum effect. It's like, let's throw in every sort of weird cutting edge quantum physics thing.
They missed nano. If they'd gotten that, they'd have been a grand slam.
Well, make sense of this for us, Bob. Go ahead, quickly.
Well, good luck with that. Physicists have found a link between wormholes and quantum entanglement. Yes, you heard me right, Rebecca. They found in their model that if you entangle two black holes and separate them, that a wormhole forms between them. Pause for impact. Oh, sorry, I wasn't supposed to read that. This requires a little review, though. So for the wormhole and entanglement impaired among us. So quantum entanglement, relatively briefly, it's one of those magical quote-unquote aspects of quantum mechanics that I love that reveal the universe at its most bizarre and counterintuitive and makes it just incredibly interesting, in my opinion. So basically, two quantum systems like quarks or atoms, for example, born at the same time, often share opposed qualities like spin. By their very nature, then, one has to spin up and the other one has to spin down. But quantum mechanics tells us that each of them are essentially both at the same time, which is the principle of superposition, until they are measured, or more generally, until they decohere or have their wave function collapse by interacting with the environment, which is the key thing there. So now imagine—
Observation. Does that include observation, Bob?
Well, that's what I mean. By observation and by decoherence, by wave function collapse, it's an interaction with the environment. So you don't need a consciousness for these things to exist. Yes, the moon exists without you looking at it. So now imagine they speed away for a billion years without decohering, and then you measure one, and it says, hey, I'm spin up. If you could measure its partner billions of light years away at that instant, it would say the opposite. So how did it know? You know, though you can't send real information faster than light using this method, there nonetheless appears to be some connection making any distance irrelevant and what Einstein derisively called spooky action at a distance. Wormholes, we've all heard about these, or Einstein-Rosen bridges. On the other hand, they're more of a staple of science fiction, but they're on much less firm observational ground. They've never been seen, obviously, but there are valid solutions to general relativity equations that include wormholes. So we know what they are, right? They're bridges, you know, of sorts that may provide shortcuts through space-time between black holes. So that's a little background on those two things, and this is what these scientists have been investigating. So these scientists have been studying entanglement for years. Now, they imagined entangling two black holes. Now, this isn't impossible, although it may seem pretty weird how that could possibly happen. It is conceivable that two black holes could be created together, making them entangled. That's a possibility. Another way is to have one black hole consume the radiation emitted by another black hole. And if you're shocked by that, just look up Hawking radiation. Now, the scientists then imagined pulling apart these two entangled black holes. And when they did this in their model, a wormhole was created between the two black holes. Now, in other words, the space-time geometry of a wormhole is the same if you just entangle two black holes and pull them apart. So that's the bottom line of that piece of the news item.
How can we exploit this for intergalactic travel?
I don't know how to exploit that. It's just an interesting fact. But it gets even cooler than that, if you can believe it. This idea has been extended now from a black hole to subatomic particles, which is a really interesting angle for this. Scientists have shown previously that a valid way to represent two entangled quarks, for example, are as two endpoints of some type of string in higher dimensional space. So imagine a piece of string in some higher dimensional space, which you probably can't imagine, and the endpoints would be those quarks. Now, if you separate these two quarks, this string representation becomes mathematically indistinguishable from a wormhole. So that means then that if wormholes are entangled black holes, then perhaps entangled subatomic particles like atoms or quarks are connected by extremely tiny wormholes. Which I think would be an incredibly fascinating discovery, because a lot of this craziness with quantum mechanics is you just can't wrap your head around it. You can't create a mental image.
So you say that would explain the spooky action at a distance, that two entangled particles are connected by a wormhole?
Possibly. That's one direction that's one interpretation of this. You have to keep in mind the models that the physicists used to make these insights dealt with a simplified version of space-time without gravity. So in this environment, you can't have black holes or wormholes if there's no gravity. So this may make any connections that they've uncovered just a mathematical analogy with no real physical analog. So that's definitely possible, and maybe it's even likely. So some physicists are saying that. But still, I do think that this is a fascinating area of research with some potential big payoffs. For example, if wormholes and entanglement are really connected, perhaps this will guide us to that holy grail of physics, the fusion of quantum mechanics and general relativity, quantum gravity. That would be an amazing end result if this bears any fruit. It could also help us create quantum computers or make computer systems that are essentially unhackable. That would be fantastic. But even if none of that happens, it could still give us, as Karch says, a concrete realization of the idea that wormhole geometry and entanglement can be different manifestations of the same physical reality. And that would be cool enough for me. That would be amazing, actually. So
anything that helps explain entanglement, it would be most welcome.
This is the kind of thing that makes me think that someday we might be able to travel faster than light or go to another universe.
Well, it shouldn't.
Why the hell not? I mean, you're talking about particles that are light years away from each other communicating, right?
No, but they're not communicating. You can't communicate. You can't violate the speed of light with entangled particles. There's something deeper going on, Jay. It's not that they're really communicating instantaneously across billions of light years.
Right, and that's an important concept. There is some sort of connection that we can't wrap our heads around, but you can never use it to transmit information because it's random. You'll never know what you're transmitting.
So they're pre-programmed at the point of creation, and then they go on their way no matter where they go. They're always going to maintain that.
That's one way to look at it, is that they're playing out some predetermined, even though it seems like the wave function's random, but it's actually playing out something that must be pre-programmed in there. But when they interact too much with their environment, they then lose their program, right? It pushes them off of that predetermined path. That's one way to explain the appearance of entanglement.
Perhaps, right? but I like to look at it as when they're entangled, they are one entity. They're one thing. And it just so happens that two pieces of them are separated. It doesn't mean that they're still not this one thing. As long as they're in this superposition.
Right. But if we do come up with a nice, neat explanation for entanglement, we can stuff that in Deepak Chopra's face.
Yeah, right.
Huh. That's the big picture here.
Nice.
All right, Rebecca, you're going to tell us about home genetic testing.
23andMe is in the news right now. It's probably the most popular company of late offering personal genetic testing. For $99, you get a little kit, and inside the kit is a tube. You spit in the tube and you send it back to 23andMe, and they process it. They check out your DNA and they let you know interesting things about it, like information about your ancestry or genetic mutations that might influence your health in some way. It's that latter point that is under the microscope right now. The FDA has contacted 23andMe. They've published a letter stating that 23andMe must cease marketing their tests because it is considered a medical device, which thereby falls under the FDA's regulations. The problem that the FDA claims is that 23andMe hasn't been working with them closely enough. They say that they had been in discussions, but 23andMe had dropped the ball and hadn't gotten back to them in several months. And so the FDA was pissed off about that and asked them to stop marketing the kits. And on Monday, 23andMe, this past Monday, 23andMe did comply with that order and have stopped marketing the kits, although they are still selling them online, I believe. The biggest concern the FDA seems to have is that consumers will use the tests and then take drastic actions based on the results. Like, for instance, 23andMe tests the BRCA1 and 2 genes, which we talked about previously, after Angelina Jolie tested positive for a mutation on one of those genes, she had a double mastectomy to prevent herself from contracting breast cancer, since that mutation drastically increases your chance of getting breast cancer. So they're concerned that if a consumer gets word back that they have one of these mutations, they might go out and have a double mastectomy. Or maybe they could learn that they are at risk of blood clots, and so they may stop taking certain medications without consulting their doctor. Things like that. Also, just the unnecessary worry that can come with false positives. And so the FDA thinks that 23andMe is misrepresenting their tests, overselling what customers can actually expect to know from what is at heart just a partial examination of their genome that may or may not be accurate, considering that there's no real oversight to guard against mistakes. There are a lot of opinions about what's happening right now. It's actually, I find it all absolutely fascinating. And so for a lot of people, they're critical of for-profit personal genetics tests for the same reason the FDA is. There are also a lot of people kind of on the other side who are worried that the FDA is going to limit their freedom to evaluate their own DNA, something they feel belongs to them and that they should have the right to have access to if they want to pay for it. I fall into both groups, just to put that out there. But I do agree with the FDA in a couple of ways. If what they report is accurate, 23andMe has utterly failed to be proactive about maintaining a good working relationship with them, which is just ridiculous. And it's not something I expect from a company that I trust with this sort of information. Also, I'd personally like for the FDA to maintain oversight of companies like 23andMe, if only to ensure that the results are going to be as accurate as possible. But where I start to disagree with the FDA's concern that they need to regulate these tests is this idea that people will, by default, take the information that's given to them and make rash, dangerous medical decisions because they don't understand genetics or probabilities. It's completely true that people can be stupid and foolhardy. We talk about that literally every week on this show. But I think that there's only so much companies can do to be sure something like this isn't being misused. And from what I've read on 23andMe's website, they already make it very clear that they only test for certain mutations, and not even all of them when it comes to hot issues like the breast cancer stuff. They make it very clear that they are only testing for something like 2 or 3 of the mutations that could lead to breast cancer. And they're upfront about the fact that your environment plays a huge role in your health and how your genes aren't your destiny. They make it really clear that any potentially negative results, any results at all, should be discussed with your doctor if you're at all concerned about them. So, I mean, in the end, the only way to stop stupid people from misusing 23andMe data is to stop companies from making that data available. And I don't personally think that's a good decision. The FDA isn't doing that yet. They're just demanding that the company not market the kits as a medical device.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you a little bit, Rebecca, in that we had a long discussion because I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine. The comments were pretty lively. And yeah, lots of people were like, hell, this is information about me, about my genetics. The government should not be able to prevent me from getting information about myself, which I agree with. But the point I made was that your right to information about yourself does not relieve the company of their responsibility of giving you that information in its proper context.
Well, and so, I don't think we disagree. That's actually exactly what I said.
I think it goes beyond that. So, yeah, sure, the disclaimer, education, that's fine. But you could argue that that could never go far enough. So this is also coming into the context of there's already a certain ethic that has developed around giving genetic information to patients. It's actually very tightly regulated. Just even for me as a physician and certainly as a researcher, there are certain ethics involved in giving patients information about their genetics. And one thing that you can't do is give patients genetic information that hasn't been properly clinically vetted. So like if I'm doing a research project, I actually was involved in research that involved testing for genes in patients, I couldn't tell the subjects of those studies the results of their genetic tests because they haven't been properly validated in terms of their clinical implications. So the problem is that 23andMe is giving, this is one problem, this is where the FDA has a perfectly legitimate concern. It goes beyond accuracy. It's what are the clinical implications of this information? And if we don't know that, you can't put it in the proper context because we don't scientifically know what the proper context is. And the company is giving their clients the false impression of knowledge that we don't have. The other major problem is that one, as soon as you attach this to any clinical implications, then by definition, this becomes a medical screening test. And you, again, beyond just the simple notion of accuracy, then you have to ask, well, for, like, as with any screening test, what are the net effects of doing this test on the general population? And they can easily become a net negative, even without people panicking, you know, and running out and cutting their breasts off or whatever. I mean, just the fact that you can lead somebody to a false sense of security, or you can lead them to be concerned about something that they would never have to be really concerned about. And that could lead to unnecessary testing, which then has its own potential downside. Medical misadventures can be triggered by the most innocuous piece of information.
But Steve, what are you proposing is different? Because I listened to everything Rebecca had to say, and I think for the most part, you guys completely agree.
Well, I think we are largely in agreement, but I do, you know, when it comes to the bottom line is should this company be allowed to give genetic information to people not in the context of a medical consultation? That's really the question. Sometimes it's very counterintuitively screening tests can be a net negative. We tend to think that all information is good and we should have the right to as much information as we want. But in medicine, everything is a risk versus benefit, and even more information may have more risk than benefit. And so they shouldn't make that health claim that this is going to be useful to your health, because we don't know that.
One thing to be slightly fair to 23andMe, and I don't think that this necessarily makes up for any claims that they have made in that regard, but they have published peer-reviewed research suggesting that, focused on the BRCA1 and 2 genes, showing that patients who tested positive for that gene that were customers of 23andMe, in their study, I think all but one said that they were happy to have that information. And of those who tested negative, none of them reported any irresponsible actions like foregoing cancer screening and things like that. I would like to see the FDA running studies on 23andMe consumers to see what effect it has. And I would like to see 23andMe working more closely with physicians, because this is something that is going to hugely impact physicians. And honestly, whether 23andMe goes under or not, this is the future, and physicians are going to have to deal with it. So, you know, I think if they can work with them to make this as easy as possible on them, I think everybody would benefit.
Yeah, I agree. The genie's probably out of that bottle, but we do have to think about all these issues rather than just assume that's a good thing. Yep. All right. Well, Evan, it's time to get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Thank you, Steve. We'll play for you right now last week's Noisy. Here we go.
Even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, agreeing with most of the scientific community, says that it puts very little trust in any attribution of hurricanes to global warming.
What do you think of that statement?
Trying to sow, doubt into anthropogenic global warming. I would point out, though, that the consensus is not that global warming increases the number of hurricanes, just their severity when they do occur.
So if I were to tell you that was Bjorn Lomborg, would you believe that?
Bjorn Lomborg.
Sure. The tennis player?
Yes, that's right. All those Jimmy Connors matches and John McEnroe. Yes. No, Bjorn Lomborg, a Danish author, academic, and writer. Perhaps he is best known for his best-selling and controversial book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, which came out in 2001.
Yes.
Which critics and his peers pretty much tore to pieces, I think.
Yeah, Scientific American decided to dedicate an issue to ripping apart every claim in the book.
Yeah. There's a Danish Committees on Scientific Dishonesty. And because they got numerous complaints about his work, they actually did an investigation into it. The charges claim that the book contained deliberately misleading data and flawed conclusions. The conclusion of the committee was such that they're calling it kind of a mixed message. They decided the book was scientifically dishonest, but Lomborg himself not guilty because of a lack of expertise in the fields.
He's an economist, right?
He was writing about
environmental issues.
I think his position has softened
years. He moderated a little bit, yeah.
So several correct answers for that one. But this week's winner is Ewan Compton. He guessed correctly. That was Bjorn Lomborg. Well done, Ewan. Your name goes into the drawing, which is coming up in a couple weeks, in which we're going to have a grand prize winner from the year of all the correct Who's That Noisy guesses. And they're going to be joining us on the show in early 2014 for an episode of Science or Fiction. So well done, Ewan.
And this week?
Moving on. For this week, we have yet another noisy.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the official email address for Who's That Noisy submissions, or go on to our forums at sguforums.com. If you don't have an account there, go ahead and create one, join the community, give us your guess. Good luck, everyone.
Joining us now are Tim Farley and Susan Gerbic. Tim and Susan, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
And for those who don't know, Tim Farley is a research fellow for the James Randi Educational Foundation, the creator of the website whatstheharm.net, which we mention all the time on the show, and also blogs about internet techniques for skeptics at skeptools.com. And Susan Gerbic is the co-founder of the Monterey County Skeptics, a member of the Independent Investigations Group, and the founder of Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia and the World Wikipedia Project, which is what you two are here to talk about tonight. So, Susan, why don't you give us an encapsulation? What is Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia?
Well, Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia is a little over 2 years old. I started it because Tim said it was a great idea. Wikipedia is the source of all knowledge. And we decided that we need to improve skeptic pages, create pages, create skeptical content, because it's very important that the world is able to get great knowledge. So we've been, working on this in many different languages for a little over 2 years. And now I have a forum that we can discuss all the page edits, we can train, we can create videos, we can create commercials for podcasts, we can create podcasts. It's a little world, a little empire that we have that I'm always looking for new recruits, especially people who can speak and read and write in other languages.
So why does it take so much effort to edit Wikipedia? I mean, back in the day, you could just sign on there and start editing away, but that's not the case anymore, huh?
Oh, no, you can easily do that. But what we want to do is we want to train. We want to make sure that people are
editing correctly. There's a lot of rules, and they call it biting. You know, some of the older editors might bite some of the newer editors who come in and try to make changes. So we really want to coddle, I guess, our editors for a little bit, make sure that they know what they're doing, understand the process so we can follow the rules, as well as maybe put more focus on things that need to be done. We're very critical about how we edit pages. When we roll out a page, it has seen many, many eyes before we release it to Wikipedia.
Yeah, what I've seen in the past when I've pushed Wikipedia on skeptic forums and stuff is I occasionally get skeptics who are, I tried to do that once and they took the edit I put in out immediately. And what's happened over the years is, if you remember from the early days of Wikipedia when it first started, they were desperate for material, and it was super easy to add stuff because they wanted to get it, you know, articles written as quickly as possible. But as the thing's grown up and attracted attention, they have to be more careful about what gets added and what gets, you know, left in and what gets taken out. And so all these various rules have come up about reliable sources and secondary sources and things like that. And they tend to bite you if you don't take a little bit of time to learn the rules and go slow at first. And I found a lot of skeptics jump in there with both feet and then, you know, get their fingers burned, so to speak, and then they say, oh, no, Wikipedia is not interested in it, and it couldn't be further from the truth. If you actually, you know, take the time to learn the rules, you can be very, very productive on Wikipedia, and the rules are actually pro-skeptic. They're mm-hmm. oriented towards scientific evidence and scientific consensus, and there are rules against putting in fringe crackpot theories, and stuff gets taken out all the time because there's no evidence for it. So
they have some standard of scholarship now to back up the mm-hmm. edits. And when you say that you might, the old editors might bite you, you mean that they'll just remove the work that you did.
Or they'll slap you down with some snarky comment that makes you not want to edit Wikipedia because they're, you know, they use a lot of jargon, and it takes a little bit of time to learn the jargon, even though they're constantly giving you the links to what the jargon means. It's like a different world. It's not difficult to edit Wikipedia. I mean, the links, and it's not like learning a whole new computer language or anything like that. It's not difficult. It's just a culture, and it can be kind of overwhelming to people at first. So I coddle them. Like I said, we really practice. We start with spelling errors. We start with grammar. We start with adding periods, taking periods out, removing citations, putting in small things. And then everything's done in our user space offline, where it's not seen by the general public. And we look it over and look it over, and people critique it, and we look it over again. And then when it's finally released, it should be done in good quality and good scholarship.
So do you use that as a way to get your name recognized by the other editors, so they don't jump on you in the beginning? You're just making the minor tweaks to get like a level of familiarity?
Well, sort of. You really need to build a history, and you don't want to just jump in and just start editing, because that's a little suspicious. It kind of sounds like you're coming in with an agenda. So we do ask that you start with a history of small edits. It does look good, because it looks like you're trying to improve Wikipedia overall and not just some specific person's page.
Yeah. And that exact thing has happened in the recent unpleasantness, where people have come in and suddenly started full speed editing one article. And it's always a red flag when somebody comes in and they're just editing this one article repeatedly and over and over and over. The other people on Wikipedia are wondering, well, are you interested in Wikipedia at all, or are you just interested in this one article?
What if you have an expert who has a very narrow area of expertise, and that's the one article that they're looking to update?
I mean, they don't immediately slap you down if you're putting in the footnotes and following the rules and, you know, documenting your work. You'll be fine, but it is something that sort of sets you aside. So one of the things I always tell, and Susan tells her people, and I tell people, is if a skeptic wants to get involved, don't just edit skeptic stuff. Try to find some other things that you're interested in, you know, Star Trek or nanotechnology. I do a lot of stuff about buildings and historic stuff here in Atlanta.
Good choices.
So like there's a historic building that's used as a concert venue, and I wrote a whole big long history of the building because it's a 100-year-old building, and wrote that for Wikipedia. And it helps build up your history and people see that you're interested in Wikipedia and not just trying to push an agenda.
But it is still true that anybody can sign up to be an editor and start editing.
Yep.
It's just that it'll be hard unless you know the culture.
Right.
And you build this history.
Right.
So for the skeptics out there who want to make the world a better place by, you know, adding their edits to Wikipedia, is there a primer or someplace they could go where they could get a one-page sort of, all right, this is what you got to know if you want to be a Wikipedia editor?
There's a couple places. I've got some blog posts on my site at skeptools.com. There's a Wikipedia link right at the top of the page. If you go in there, there's a whole bunch of articles I've written, and there's a couple of kind of starting up. Here's how you set up your account. Here's how you do simple edits like spelling changes and reverting vandalism. And then Susan has taken it a lot deeper, and she's done a bunch of videos on YouTube with much deeper stuff about how to do different types of edits and what they're doing with the Guerrilla Skeptics.
Now, this all came up. The reason why, you know, we're getting you guys on the show now is because of Rupert Sheldrake and Deepak Chopra have been complaining about you guys.
Yeah.
they're trying to portray you as skeptical vandals going in and, you know, spreading your skepticism through Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. I've actually spent some time going back through the blog posts and going back through the histories of the articles on Wikipedia. And all their posts about it are amazingly evidence-free, which is striking with Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is very, very open. The history of every article is there. You can see every single edit to every single article all the way back. You can see every edit that individual editors have made. You can see the hit counts on articles, so you know which articles are popular and which ones aren't. You can see all the discussions all the way back to trivial discussions that were, you know, had 6 years ago about editing two words in a sentence. They're all there. So there's plenty of information about who's editing it and when they're editing it and why they're editing it. And none of these posts by Sheldrake or Deepak have dug into any of that. And yet they somehow latched on to Susan. And basically it all boils down to a blog post way back in March by Robert McLuhan. He's a spiritualist, psi-type person who's written a book about the Million Dollar Challenge that's apparently very critical of Randy. He blogged about Susan's project, and it wasn't an especially angry blog, but he pointed out some things in Wikipedia that he didn't like and said some things about, well, maybe we should be, we, the psi believers, should be getting our own group together. And it was there that Sheldrake picked it up. Sheldrake mentions McLuhan in his first blog post, which was on June 20th. And actually, this afternoon, I went back and looked at the history of Sheldrake's article. And until McLuhan and Sheldrake and later Deepak Chopra were blogging about it, Sheldrake's article actually wasn't being edited that much at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in February of this year, no one edited it at all that entire month. And all the way back to June 2012, it typically would get like 5 edits a month, 6 edits a month, 3 edits a month. You know, very typical for a lesser article like that. And then all of a sudden, after Robert McLuhan's post, in April, it's getting 21 edits, and then 26, and in June, it shot up, and it accelerated from there, and a large number of editors were editing the article. And what was happening, from what I can tell, is people were stepping on each other's toes and getting in each other's way, and there were a lot of clearly very new editors to Wikipedia jumping in, I presume as a result of these blog posts, and trying to edit. And there was one editor in particular in June who made most of the edits in June, who had a weird random string for their name on Wikipedia, and eventually got blocked and was accused of being a sock puppet. And in August and September was blocked off of Wikipedia because their edits they were making were not productive. And that was kind of the start of it. And it's gone on from there. There was another editor by the name of Tumbleman who came in around August, and he had a post on his own kind of profile page on Wikipedia that somebody dug up that basically said he was doing an experiment in social psychology by editing the Rupert Sheldrake page and seeing how people reacted. Essentially, he admitted he was trolling the other editors on that page. And people accused him of it, and he deleted that from his user page. And he created all sorts of havoc on the page. And that brought in another blogger by the name of Craig Wheeler, who's blogged about it a few times. And that's how it got to Deepak Chopra, I think, because Deepak Chopra mentioned Craig Wheeler's blog. But neither one, neither Tumbleman nor Craig Wheeler, made that many constructive edits. In fact, I was laughing with Susan earlier because I found a blog post that Craig Wheeler made where he referred to Sheldrake's article as my article on Wikipedia, which is something you never do. You never, you know, assume ownership of a Wikipedia article. He's made one edit to the Sheldrake article, one, over the entire time. And that one edit was he deleted something, a footnote. And that's it. That's it. And yet in his blog, if you read his blog, you would think he was making these gigantic edits that the skeptics were removing every day. He wasn't. He's been arguing with people on Wikipedia. He's only made about 60 edits, and then he finally gave up. He posted a thing on his blog that the only way to win the Wikipedia game is to not play. And,
well, good riddance, right?
Exactly.
It sounds like they can't get their shit together.
No.
And they're just complaining because you guys do have your shit together and you're actually making constructive evidence-based scholarly edits.
Right.
And they just don't like what the scholarship has to say.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Wikipedia in general for a bit because Wikipedia has an interesting reputation. It's all over the place. I mean, if you do research on almost anything, you know, any basic topic, Wikipedia comes up on the first page, if not the first hit.
Right.
For most things. And yet, you know, teachers, for example, usually do not allow students to reference Wikipedia. I mean, for no other reason, because it's by definition a secondary source. So it sort of has a bad reputation among scholars, and yet it's emerging as it's the closest thing to the one reservoir of human knowledge that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of in this strange place. In terms of its reputation as a source of information.
Right. And, you know, Steve, it's a great point. We hear a lot about how bad Wikipedia is, but it is the source of all knowledge. You can't beat its Google hits. There's the results. There's no way that anybody can write a blog, do a podcast, or anything of that sort that's going to get the hit views that a Wikipedia page receives. In fact, just take one, for example, homeopathy. The most popular blogger out there can do an article on Wikipedia on homeopathy, write, you know, great evidence, cite great sources, and they're not even to get close to the 100,000 views a month, every month for years that Wikipedia is going to get. And, you know, this BS about not being able to cite it on scholarly, you know, for articles and things like that. That's nice. I hear that all the time. People are always talking about you can't cite, you know, Wikipedia, but everyone goes to Wikipedia.
Right.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so they can frail their arms and they can fling their arms about and, you know, wave their hands and so on about how bad Wikipedia is, but it is where everyone is going. And there are great sources on a lot of pages that people can find when they go to familiarize themselves with a topic, to get a general overview of a historical piece or one of our scientists or global warming, and then follow the citations to get really good information and then cite those. So, you know,
that's the key that I think a lot of educational people who have a more nuanced view of Wikipedia always emphasize is, you know, skim the article, maybe use the article as a starting point, but one of the first things you're going to do is go down to the bottom of the article and look at the footnotes. And for a well-written article, There will be exhaustive footnotes down there, and where those footnotes lead are the sources that you're probably going to want to really be reading after you've got, you know, sort of your Cliff Notes view from the article itself. And it varies from article to article. You know, a lot of articles are very poor and have just a couple of footnotes and not very good sources. And there are other articles that have hundreds and hundreds of footnotes down there to very scholarly sources and will really send you exactly where you need to be.
It does seem like it's this is a place where it's worthwhile for us as a community to put our efforts, because this is the show. This is the resource that people go to, you know.
And one of the big things that Susan has focused on, and I've focused on myself, mainly just to kind of stay out of a lot of these controversies like Sheldrake and Chopra, is not necessarily diving into the controversial pseudoscience articles, but editing the articles on the other side that just document the skeptic movement. So writing biographies, for instance, I wrote George Rabb's biography on Wikipedia. I wrote Harriet Hall's. I wrote most of Karen Stolzno's bio. And, you know, it's just a matter of finding someone like that who clearly Harriet Hall is notable enough to be in Wikipedia, and she didn't happen to have an article. So I just sat down and started digging up references of stuff that she's written and stuff that she's done and wrote it up and put it in there. And it helps document skepticism for the general public. You know, when somebody sees an article by Harriet Hall and they go, well, who is this Harriet Hall person? They Google her name. There's a whole bio of her on Wikipedia.
We specialize in that. We call that project We Got Your Wiki Back. And we've done that time and time again with our in our forum. What we're trying to do is we're really trying to improve the pages of our skeptical spokespeople. And that includes, you know, the SGU as well as many other skeptical organizations and spokespeople. Because what we want is when you are in the media, we know that you're going to get Googled. We know that you're going to get high stats, because we can see that. We have a way of looking at your stats and see how many hits come to your Wikipedia page each day. And we can look at that and we can say, well, so-and-so is in the news, so we got to make sure that their page is in really good shape, and we need to make sure that the links are going from there to scientific skepticism, to the different organizations, to the different kinds of things we have. And it needs to be done in all languages. In fact, we've written the SGU page, I believe, in other, I think we just did Portuguese just recently, not so long ago. So, you know, we have to have the pages done in English really great, and then they get translated into other languages from different people on my team.
Wow.
That is awesome. That's fantastic.
All right. So, guys, you're going to provide me with some links for anyone listening to the show who wants to get involved as a wiki editor or directly with you guys in the Guerrilla Skepticism Project.
Yep.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us tonight, and thanks for all the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Dun, dun, dun.
The theme is how many? And we have four items.
How many?
Oh. There are four items. Okay, here they are. The human body has more than 12 distinct types of sensation without dividing taste, smell, vision, or hearing into subtypes. Number two, there are 6 known moons of Pluto, 5 named, and 83 confirmed moons of Jupiter. Number three, there are 11 known states of matter, not counting non-classical states or purely theoretical states. And item number four, there are currently 6 people in space. So obviously, this is all about the numbers. One of those numbers is incorrect.
I'm not a fan of this.
Jay, go first.
Okay, so this first one, I do believe that there are other types of sensations other than the 5 obvious senses that we have. And I'm not dipping into sense hunger or any of that nonsense that L. Ron Hubbard wants us to believe. And the second one here, that there are 6 known moons of Pluto. Oh, wow. I don't even know if Pluto has any moons. That's how bad this one is. You're supposed to know stuff like that, Bob, and I'm supposed to know about yelling and bad accents.
And Thanksgiving.
And thank you. Yeah, yeah, and where was my Thanksgiving science or fiction, Steve? Really, really.
It's true.
You did me wrong, son. I'm not sure about the Pluto one. And I just hate having to admit to myself that I don't know more information about that. And the final one, that there are 11 known states of matter. Damn you! I believe there are 6 people in space right now, so that's the 4th one. I'm going to say that's science. And between 2 and 3, I'm going to say that there are not 11 states of matter.
Okay. Evan?
For the 12 distinct types of sensation in the human body, that really doesn't make sense to me. Certainly not what we're taught in school, but that doesn't mean a damn thing these days. I'm having a problem with this one. Distinct types. I don't know that they're distinct. A lot of things are connected. 6 known moons of Pluto, 5 named. 83 confirmed moons of Jupiter. That's a lot. I always thought Jupiter was kind of in the 40s or 50s, but, you know, they're always finding new moons. I would not be surprised. 11 known states of matter. Well, sure, I'm tending to think that that one is correct. You know, please don't ask me to name them because I couldn't get all 11, I think, in under the worst of circumstances. And then this last one. There are currently 6 people in space. You know, what can you say about that? There either is or there isn't. And you kind of just have to take a guess with that one. So it's coming down to the 6 people in space or 12 distinct types of sensation. Given those 2 options that I've narrowed it down to, I'm going to have to say that the 12 distinct types of sensation, I'll say, is the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Oh, man. That was the one that I thought was science, because I don't know about 12, but I know that there are other senses, like sense of balance, I know, is one that people don't ordinarily think of. And there must be more. Like, I feel like psychologists are always coming up with new senses. Like, what about the sense that you're like an individual? You know, there are people who have brain damage who lose certain senses about themselves, and it's really freaky. So I don't know. I feel like that one could be true. 6 known moons of Pluto, 83 moons of Jupiter. No idea. Honestly, I have no idea. 11 known states of matter. I mean, I know the solid, liquid, gas, plasma. That's 4. What else could there be? I don't know. Do Newtonian liquids? Is that a... I don't think so. I'm sure that there must be some other crazy states of matter that I don't know about, but I don't know. And I have no idea how many people are in space at any one time. How do we even define space? We can't, Steve. Somebody just went into space and came back just now while I was answering this question. So I don't know. I guess I'm going to go with the states of matter one, because I feel like 11 is too many states of matter, but I'm probably way wrong.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, this is tough. These numbers are good. They're just outside of the range that I'm comfortable in. Yeah, for distinct sensations, I kind of like what Evan was saying about how 12 distinct ones definitely seems high. A lot of them are just kind of fusion of different sensations. The moons of Pluto, I wasn't aware of the 6th one, and 83 for Jupiter. Yeah, I just lost count, and that seems a little high, but not that high. The 11 known states of matter. That seems high as well. I mean, there's a bunch of them besides the obvious plasma, Bose-Einstein condensate. There's these quasi-crystals.
You know, of course,
Bob knows.
Quark, gluon, plasma.
You know, the obvious ones, the Bose-Einstein crystal.
He was reading a paper on that earlier today.
No, I said beside the obvious, solid, liquid, gas.
Oh, okay.
But even for those, I remember thinking, that's it. I've just officially lost track of how many states of matter there are. There are just all these obscure ones. Some of them are fascinating. Other ones were kind of not as fascinating. But that still seems high to me. And people in space, I really don't know. 6 sounds reasonable. And part of me is thinking that that's such a simple little thing. There's 6 people in space, and that's going to be the fiction. And nobody's going to pick it. Jay, what did you pick?
I... I said that the 11 known states of matter.
Screw it. I'm going with the 6 people in space.
Right, Bob. Good for okay. you.
All right. So the one that you all agree on is that there are 6 known moons of Pluto, 5 named, and 83 sure. confirmed moons of Jupiter. You all think that is science.
Gosh.
Wait, can I change my mind?
No.
No. I know.
And that one is the fiction.
Of course it is.
Because excuse, Steve.
Because there are 5 moons of Pluto, Bob.
Right.
Not discovered the 6th. Those moons are, come on, you should know how many moons Pluto
there
has.
There are no moons
Why?
Of Pluto.
Charon.
Oh my god,
that.
We talked about it. Nyx and the other
yeah,
one.
Yeah, Nyx and how we just
Why do
about
I
this.
Ever need
Charon,
to know about
Styx,
that?
Charon, Styx, Nyx, Kerberos, and Hydra.
Kerberos, right.
And Jupiter has 67 confirmed moons. Not
There's
even
a lot of people listening to this show right now that were in the same exact shoes as I was in. Admit it, people.
I was right
a lot
about
of you
Jupiter.
Didn't know. There was no, nobody knew that there were any moons of Jupiter. There were no moons what? Of Jupiter before the recording of this program.
Jupiter, you mean Pluto.
Whatever.
Same deal.
Jupiter has 67 moons. All right, let's go back over the other ones in order. The human body has more than 12 distinct types of sensation without dividing taste, smell, vision, or hearing. That is science. I had to say more than 12 because there's just no way to give one number. It depends on how you divide them or count them. I said like not dividing taste because do you count bitter, you know, salt and sweet as 3 sensations or 1?
This no,
color and black and white vision could be more than one. Every smell, how many different types of receptors do we have for smell? So I say, all right, just forget those. We'll keep those as just one type of sensation. But in addition to sight, smell, sound, and taste, we have temperature, pain, proprioception, soft touch, pressure, vibration, vestibular sensation, itch, and stretch. Like, you know, when your bladder's full or if your bowel is distended.
That's Isn't itch just a form of pain?
That's 13. Nope. There's a distinct receptor for it. That's 13. I got over 12, so I just said more than 12. There's more, whatever.
I knew it. I was right. Thank you.
Bastard.
Yeah, they actually discovered that there's – I mean, and they're distinct. They have distinct receptors, pathways.
Steve,
I mean, they're
I got one that you did not think of. Detect fart.
Detect fart?
No, because you know the difference.
I believe that's pressure.
Yeah,
Rebecca, think
that's
about
a combination
it.
Of stretch and odor.
You know that it, there's a difference. You know whether you have to go to the bathroom or you have to fart. Or else we'd all be shitting our pants.
Well, hopefully you do. Sometimes
we'll call that
people
the J principle. Always.
So when people I've named it Detect Fart. Thank you.
Isn't that a Scientology power?
Yeah, right. yeah, right.
All right, there are 11 known states of matter, not counting non-classical states and purely theoretical states. So I had to throw that caveat in there because there's all sorts of possible states of matter. And I'm sure somebody could you know, come in and say, no, there's only 11, there's only 10 or there's 12 or whatever. But here are the 11, you know, I tried to, you gotta draw the line somewhere between how much confirmation is enough to say it's, you know, we know that it
right.
exists. But here's the,
right.
here are the 11 I thought were above the board. Solid, liquid, gas, plasma. You all know about that. Superfluid. Mm-hmm. Bose-Einstein yeah. condensate, fermionic condensate, Rydberg molecule, photonic matter, degenerate matter, and quark gluon plasma.
What about a quasi-crystal?
Those are non-classical states.
What about dark matter?
Dark matter is purely theoretical.
What? Wait a minute. What do you mean purely theoretical?
We don't know what it is. It's just theorized that it must exist.
But we know it exists?
There was like 10 other ones that theoretically should exist. We have no idea what it is. I didn't count those.
That's awesome. Read those again.
But the list could be a lot more. I mean, there's a lot more things
excited.
Potentially
Go
on the list.
Google it and read it yourself.
Solid, liquid, gas, plasma, superfluid, Bose-Einstein condensate, fermionic condensate, Rydberg molecule, photonic matter, which we talked about recently, degenerate matter, like in a neutron star, and
yeah.
quark-gluon plasma. Quark-gluon plasma is on the fence about because it,
Why?
Well, because how confirmed is it? We've definitely detected it in particle accelerators, but it's not 100% confirmed, but I thought it was above
come
the bar.
On. Yeah, it is.
I think my cat is a new state of matter because he's soft and squishy. I can touch him, but he also seems – so that's like a solid, but he also seems to fill any space like a gas. So like a very tiny box or a very large box, he can fill it perfectly.
And Rebecca, that's another sense. Detect cat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there are currently 6 people in space. They are – Oleg Kotov, Mike Hopkins, and Sergei Ryanansky. They've all been in space for 70 days. Rick Mastracchio, Mikhail Tyurin, and Koichi Wakata have been in space for 28 days.
Hey, Koichi.
So how many people are
He listens to the show.
So there's two Americans, three Russians, and a and one Japanese.
Hey, I heard Koichi went home, so I think I win.
What do you mean? How could he have gone home?
he was homesick.
Tired of it.
He had his parents pick him up.
No, he just there's a website. Shut up.
There's a website called howmanypeoplearein.com.
Really?
That's awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
What is it? Just one big number six on the screen? What?
Yes, exactly. There's a picture of the Earth. There's a big number six on the screen. And then below that are the names. But yes, that's
wow.
That is awesome.
What's the highest that number's ever been, I wonder?
I don't know.
Oh, gosh.
Should know.
Is there a website, what's the most people who have ever been in space.com?
We need to make one. Yeah.
Did you say Rydberg atom?
Molecule.
How did they? So they classify that as a separate state of matter?
Rydberg molecule. They did, yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. Because isn't that where the molecule is, the electron is so far away that it actually exhibits classical and quantum characteristics?
I believe so, yes. I could read the description for you.
Hey, Steve, I have an awesome quote.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
This is a quote sent in by Yadiel Sotomayor. And he is a philosophy student, and he read this during his final exam, and I just absolutely love this quote. It's a quote by John Stuart Mill, and
I love
it
his
reads,
show.
The real advantage which truth has consists in this, that when an opinion is true, it may be extinguished once, twice, or many times, but in the course of ages, there will generally be found persons to rediscover it, until some one of its reappearances falls on a time when, from favorable circumstances, it escapes persecution until it has made such head as to withstand all subsequent attempts to suppress it. John Stuart Mill!
Truth wins out in the end.
I kind of read that like truth is woven into the fabric of space-time in a way where it's inevitable that it'll be discovered and found out. And
it's one of the states of matter.
Yeah. Or it's one of the moons
of Jupiter.
Of
yeah.
It hasn't been named yet, though.
Steve.
Hey, don't forget there's still time to get your SGU swag and gift memberships. Just stop by our membership page or the store page on the SGU website. This week we have a really interesting premium content. We have a long discussion of the proposed thorium generator, which proponents say should be small enough to power a thorium car, a car that could last for 100 years on just 8 grams of fuel. So we'll dive into that, and you can listen to all of our premium content if you become an SGU member at the Damned Dirty Ape level or higher. Well, guys, thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Sure, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.